So this is our first week in our new series, you know, Jesus Said What? And it's a series about just the confusing and the hard things that Jesus said that it'll help us lead into our Easter season. And these statements really put Jesus at the front and center of history. And as I've explained at times, Jesus typically calls two types of reactions. You either hated him or you loved him. You either wanted to be his best friend and to follow him, or you wanted to basically kill him. There wasn't really much in between. It was those two extremes. Now, the irony today is that a lot of people feel that they're bored with Jesus, that he just isn't interesting. But if you go back and read the New Testament, nobody was ever bored with Jesus. Now, they may have considered him a phony, they may have considered him a false prophet or whatever, but nobody was bored with him. So that tells me that those people really haven't engaged Jesus at all, if they think he's bored at all, boring at all. Because if you've engaged him, you will find him anything but boring. You will find him extremely interesting. And so what we find is that a lot of people who really engage with Jesus tend to cause waves because they take seriously the things that he has said. And these hard things will bring us face to face with the real Jesus. And that's what we're going to do with this little short 2-week series, is these hard questions or these hard sayings will bring us face to face with the real Jesus. So we're going to look at Mark 13, starting in verse 32. And so in Mark 13, Jesus is prophesying about the end times and about the end of the world. And he tells his disciples about some ominous things that's going to happen, about the earth, basically a big earthquake is going to come, the sun is going to be darkened, which those things in themselves are kind of hard to fathom. Well, then he turns to verse 32, and he says this, "But about that day, no one, or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." So that raises the question, Jesus, how do you know you're not coming, when you're coming back? I mean, aren't you the Son of God? Aren't you God? Aren't you supposed to know everything? How do you not know that? How do you not know your own calendar? How do you not know that you're coming back? Maybe, is this showing that he really wasn't God? Well, absolutely not. There's a few things that we need to realize. And the first thing that we need to realize is that Jesus is described with some type of limitation throughout the Gospels. In Luke 5:52, it tells us that Jesus increased in wisdom and stature. How can Jesus increase in wisdom and stature when he's God? And, you know, Hebrews tells us that Jesus increased in wisdom. How can the all-knowing God get wiser? You know, And so Hebrews also tells us that he learned obedience, which means he had to learn to do certain things, like maybe to eat his vegetables. And, you know, you may be thinking, it's like, well, didn't Jesus already know that? Didn't he make antioxidants? And didn't he know to always eat the good food? Well, it appears in Scripture that Jesus did have to learn some things on earth, just like we had to learn them. And most of us kind of see Jesus as this baby savant, like waxing poetically to other 3-year-olds about the Christological implications of Leviticus 13, you know, and just going on and on about the deep theological concepts in the book of Deuteronomy. And so we sometimes think of Jesus being that way. But listen, the 3-year-old Jesus had 3-year-old thoughts. He thought, I hope my dad makes me a toy today. Or he may be thinking, man, these Twizzlers are really good. I would love some more Twizzlers. Like, he had 3-year-old thoughts too. But we wonder, how can this be since he's God? Well, let's do a little theology lesson. From the beginning, Christians have believed that the incarnate Jesus, which means the Jesus that came to earth, born of a virgin, that Jesus was 100% fully God, but he was also 100% fully man. He wasn't 50-50. He wasn't 50% man. He wasn't 50% God. He was 100% of both. So in other words, being fully God did not take away from him being fully man, and him being fully man did not take away from him being fully God. You see, in order for Jesus to save us, he had to be fully of both. He had to be 100% man, or he couldn't die as a substitute for us. And he had to be 100% God, or he could not save us from sin and death. He wouldn't have been powerful enough to do that. he was both 100% man and 100% God. And because he was both, during his life, we see flashes of this. And here are some flashes that we see of it. Because he was the Son of Man, he became hungry. But because he was the Son of God, he could feed the 5,000. Because he was the Son of Man, we would see he would get thirsty. But because he was the Son of God, he could turn water into wine. And because he was the Son of Man, he grew weary, he grew tired. But because he was the Son of God, he could also raise the dead. Because he was the Son of Man, he counted his birthdays. But because he was the Son of God, he could claim that he was Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And because he was the Son of Man, he didn't know the hour of his return. But because he was the Son of God, he would promise that he would return with the clouds with great glory. And so while Jesus came to earth, he emptied himself voluntarily of some of the access of his divine powers. In humanity, he doesn't know, and he doesn't know that he's not accessing his powers. And by the way, this is one of the ways that I know that the Bible is not forged. It wasn't written by some guys just trying to make this little religious hippie in those days into a Jesus-like figure. Because wouldn't you leave this little detail out? Because if you're trying to convince someone who, like someone like you or me, that this little hippie guy is truly God, I would leave out that he didn't know certain things. I would say that he knew everything. I wouldn't say that he didn't know the time of his return. But this is telling me how much they wanted us to know the truth of who Jesus was. And that shows me that it just had to be accurate. It had to be truthful that Jesus was who he said he was. Because the writers included it not to advance their theories, but to advance the gospel and to advance God's kingdom. And so we see the reason he didn't know was because he himself had emptied himself access of that knowledge. And actually we see that being said in Philippians chapter 2. But what Jesus says next in this passage is actually very difficult too. See what it says on verse 33. It says, be on guard, be alert. You do not know when the time will come. It will be like a man going away. He leaves his house and puts his servants in charge, eat with their assigned tasks, and tells the one at the door to keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know when the owner of the house will come, whether in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or at dawn. If he comes suddenly, do not let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch. Now, here's why this is difficult. Did Jesus really think the end was near? Did he really think it was close? It kind of sounds like that, but that was like 2,000 years ago and he still hasn't returned. So some have concluded that Jesus was wrong here, that Jesus was just a product of his time. He was expecting the return, but it just didn't happen. But in fact, they point out this in the same passage in verse 30. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Well, that generation didn't pass away and the end has not come, so Jesus must have been wrong. So was Jesus wrong? Absolutely not. You see, the bigger context of what Jesus is saying here, especially in verse 30, is the destruction of the temple, if you go back to verse 2, which Jesus is talking about. And that would be a milestone in the commencement of the last days. The Messiah would be killed, the temple would be destroyed, and God would gather the Gentiles from the four corners of the world, which we see in verse 27. Well, that all took place in AD 70, which was in their lifetime. But it's clear that not everything has taken place that he's expecting to take place. For example, in verse 26, he has not come with power and glory. That hasn't happened yet. He's risen from the dead from power and glory, but he hasn't come back yet in power and glory. So it has begun, but it has not yet been completed. So is there another reason that he's telling us to remain ready? Absolutely. Jesus wants us to live in a constant state of readiness for his return. In Matthew's account, Jesus goes on of this where he's talking about him coming through the clouds or with the clouds and for us to be ready. Well, after that, he goes on to list in Matthew's account a few parables. And he talks about how when he comes, he's going to be like a thief in the night, that you'll never know when he's coming. So you never know when a thief is coming. But how awesome would it be if a thief did make appointments, like you wouldn't have to lock your doors or some night because, you know, oh, I don't have an appointment from a thief, so I don't have to lock my doors. Or tomorrow I have two appointments from a thief, so I better get my shotgun ready because we got two coming on this night. That would be great. But thieves don't operate like that. So we should be ready at all times. And this is how the return of the Son of God will be on earth. At the moment you least expect it, he will return. Well, then he gives us an example of the story of Noah and how for 120 years, God gave Noah to build an ark, but then for 120 years, nothing happened. And so, you know, after 10 years, you know, people were like, this Noah guy, he was wrong. Like, God ain't coming back. It's been 10 years. Well, 30 years, they probably didn't even remember that he had even said it. And then 120 years later, like who knows what they were thinking at that time? I mean, they were so probably far out of their memory that they weren't even contemplating that God was going to bring a flood. And so it had been so long that all they were doing was partying up. And then it finally did happen and they were not expecting it. And then he tells a story about a master who gave three large sums of money to his servants, and two of them got busy to invest the money so that when the master returned, they would have something to give back to him. Well, the third guy must have thought, well, he's not going to return anytime soon. I'm just going to go live it up and party it up, and then I'll make it up in time. Well, this master came back before he expected it, and it kind of caught him off guard, and he was like, I don't have anything to give you. And all of these examples are making the same point. We need to live in a state of readiness, like he might return today. So let me give you four things that will change in your life when you are living in a state of readiness for Jesus' return. First, it's going to give you a spiritual alertness. If you knew that Jesus was coming back tomorrow, what would change about your life today? I grew up in a time where the church talked a lot about the end times. I grew up in churches knowing that the preacher preached on the end times maybe 5 to 10 years straight. Like, he didn't stop talking about the end times, and they preached on it all the time. There were prophecy conferences that took place, and if you wanted to pack out a coliseum or a conference center or whatever it was, have a prophecy conference and you will pack the place out. You know, in those days, people had those bumper stickers like honk, or not honk if you love Jesus. You know, those are good too. But they had the bumper stickers in case of the rapture, you know, this car will be unmanned. Like that's just the things that were going on kind of when I was growing up. Well, each year I would kind of feel bad for the people because they were always claiming, you know, I feel like Jesus is coming back this year. And each and every year they became more dismayed and kind of more disappointed that Jesus didn't come back. So I would just kind of pick fun at them a little bit. I was like, hey, man, it's not the end of the world. Or I would say, you know, cheer up. You know, if you had been right the first time, then maybe there's tomorrow. You know, but if you had been right the first time, then maybe we wouldn't have to make this prediction again. I know it's easy to make fun of it now, but I do think there's one thing that the church had then that maybe it doesn't have now. There's an earnest expectation for his return. A lot of people think this doctrine is kind of the superstitious, non-essential. It's kind of the embarrassing cousin of Christian doctrine and theology. But in 260 chapters in the New Testament, the second return of Jesus is mentioned 318 times. That's one out of every 13 verses it's mentioned. And so for every prophecy in the Bible concerning Jesus' first advent of him coming as a baby, there's 8 more verses of him looking forward to his return. So we have a whole holiday celebrating his first return, but 8 times as much verses about his second return. So if you knew Jesus was coming back today, how would that change your life? What would be different about it? Wouldn't it make you ask the question, am I ready? Am I living in a way that I'm ready for his return tonight? Being ready and having a readiness for Jesus' return will make you have a spiritual alertness. Second thing it'll give you is a missional urgency. If you knew that Jesus was coming back soon, would that change your priorities? isn't that what a lot of us are doing? You know, our life is consumed with vacations, hobbies, possessions, and bucket lists. Listen, you know I'm not the guy that says that you can't go enjoy stuff in life. I believe God has created stuff for us to enjoy and to find pleasure in. And listen, I have hobbies. We do vacations. In fact, those aren't bad things. But the problem is that a lot of us live our lives as though those are the end. But that's the goal, to go have hobbies, to go have vacations. And we think that's what life is about, is the vacation and the hobbies. Listen, those things are great to help re-energize us for the purpose of the kingdom, but they are not the end in themselves. And so we see that actually those things, we don't find his kingdom in those things, but those things help energize us for the work of the kingdom. We know he is coming back, so how are you using your time, talents, and gifts for his kingdom? Listen, there's nothing wrong with a little rest and relaxation. Those things are nice, but it's not the end game. A disciple of Jesus doesn't take vacations so to just get away from things. He takes vacations so that he can re-energize for the purpose of the kingdom. It's not the end game. So the question is, are you investing your resources, your time, your talents, and your possessions for the kingdom of God? Is being ready for Jesus' second coming giving you a missional urgency because you know his second coming is near? Third, I think it gives you hope in suffering. Now, if we back up kind of to verse 26, it tells us, at that time, the Son of Man is coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Now, here's just a little observation with this. And if you've noticed, I've made sure I clarified this every time I said that. A lot of times we say he's coming through the clouds, but that's actually not what it says. It says that he's coming with the clouds or in the clouds. Now, you may be asking, Danny, why does that even matter? Why does that distinction carry any weight whatsoever? It's showing us that he's bringing back paradise. His beautiful clouds of power and glory are coming with him. The world we live in today is wrecked by pain. It's wrecked by suffering. And Jesus came to fix all that was wrong with what sin has broken. And Jesus promises us that all that sin and all that pain will not last forever, and that the pain is temporary. And, you know, we can endure a lot of stuff when we know that it's just temporary. Maybe your marriage is dissolved. Maybe you're lonely. Maybe your body is wrecked with chronic pain. If so, lift your eyes. It doesn't last forever. Jesus could return soon and your pain will be over. If your life has not turned out the way you wanted it to, then the second coming should remind you that the good old days are not behind you, but actually that they are ahead of you, because we are waiting for him to right every wrong, and we are waiting for him to fix what sin has broken. Fourth, I believe it will give you the power to forgive. You know, Tim Keller in a book pointed this out to me. He said that I've seen people who struggle with bitterness helped with their bitterness by grasping Jesus' imminent return. You know, when someone has wronged us, we want justice. So we kind of run to the judgment seat and try to cast judgment, try to get them to have some type of penalty for that we feel is appropriate. But here's the problem. When we run and try to sit on that seat is too big for us. We can't do it on our own, because how many times have you seen people who've tried to sit on that seat and tried to just seek justice and seek penalty on their own, and all it's done is driven them to bitterness, and it just ends up destroying them because they're just feeding on that. The reason is that you were never meant to sit on the seat of judgment. God was. We're on the seat of forgiveness. We're to forgive and not hold that bitterness. When someone is mad at someone else, it just colors their entire mood, entire disposition. It becomes tarnished. Or maybe you have this prejudice towards one person, and they may be in a people group, and it's tarnished your entire view of that entire people group. And the reality is that that does it because you're casting judgment on that one person. It's colored your entire view of it because you never were meant to sit on that seat. God was. We weren't meant for that throne, and the second coming helps us stay off of that seat. It's because we know he's coming back, and we know that he is bringing judgment, and that we don't have to. We can endure injustice for a time being because we know that he will set these things right. Now, those four things will change in you when you yearn for his return. Now, I know what some of you are probably asking. You're probably, well, Danny, how is it going to happen? You know, how is he going to return? What will it be like? What's going to happen? Well, unfortunately, that's a larger sermon series for a time that I don't have for today. And actually, I hope he comes back so I don't have to preach on it. But basically, there's four positions. There's pre-trib, and the tribulation is where there's a 7 years where God is not present on earth. And the pre-trib means that we're being raptured, that God will take his children with us before the tribulation happens. And so there's people who believe that his church will be raptured out, the tribulation will happen, and God will establish his kingdom after the tribulation. Then there's the post-trib people who believe that the church will actually live through the tribulation and then be taken raptured out after the tribulation, and God will establish his kingdom. Some people don't like this view because they don't feel like his return is imminent. And so they're like, well, if you know you're in the tribulation, then you know when Jesus is returning, right? So it just kind of doesn't make sense. But the crowd who believes this believe that you don't actually know you're living in the tribulation. We could be living in the tribulation now and you don't really know. The third view is kind of this called amillennialism, which believe that all that's said in the Bible and in Revelation is really metaphorical, and there's not really a tribulation, and that Jesus could return at any time. The only problem is that there's some things in Revelation that it just doesn't kind of square off with, and so it just kind of misses on a few levels. And then there's the last one, which I like to call pan-trib, which means you don't really know what you believe, but you just believe everything's going to pan out in the end. And how many of you are really there? You just like, I don't know how it's going to happen. I just know it's going to happen, and it's all going to pan out in the end. So probably many of you are wondering, well, Pastor, where are you? Here's where I'll say I am. I'm about 45% post-trib, 35% pre-trib, and I'm about 20%. I don't really know. So the question is like, how important is this? Well, it's important because it's in the Bible and we need to know that Jesus is coming. But here's what I will say. Let's don't get caught up so much in the details of how it will happen, but focus on that it will happen. I know people who are chasing conspiracy theories about some heifers in Israel trying to wait and see, okay, is this the perfect spotless heifer? Because there's some things in scripture about a heifer potentially. And it's like, is this it? Is this the sign? And they're conspiracy theory all these different things when they have neighbors who are dying and going to hell, but they're more focused on a heifer in Israel than they are about the lost around them. Don't get so caught up in all the details of how he's coming. Know he is coming, and let that change how you live your life in the here and now. And so this leads us to the question, do you yearn for his second coming? Are you living with an expectancy of Christ returning? Most of us really don't live with this expectation. It somewhat is not even a thought in our heads. And here's probably the reasons why that's not happening. Because we're so at home in this world. We spend so much of our lives trying to make this world home. C.S. Lewis says, wealth has a way that we find ourselves longing for his return, not longing for his return, because we have so much invested here. I think the second reason is because the thought of Jesus' return is mixed with a little bit of fear. Now, it's well-rounded fear. When he returns, an account has to be given for our sin, and some of us don't feel like that we're ready to give an account. And maybe you feel that you've not lived up to God's standard. And here's the truth about the human condition. We know we're guilty. We know that we're sinners, and we know that we don't want to face God. But here's an important insight that I don't want you to miss from the text. When Jesus describes Judgment Day here in Mark 13, he adds odd phrases, which I mentioned earlier. He talked about how the sun will be darkened, and at Jesus' crucifixion, do you know what happened? The sun was darkened. And do you know what also happened that he talks about? He says the earth will be shaken. Do you know what happened at the crucifixion? The earth was shook and the rock splits. So when you read chapter 13 in Mark, and then you read the story of the crucifixion, what is happening at the crucifixion, it almost looks like Judgment Day. Well, Jesus on the cross was the ultimate Judgment Day. He received the judgment in our place so that we who receive Jesus through faith as one of his children look forward to reunion of the Father without facing the judge. Jesus faced the judge for us so that we wouldn't have to. So at the first coming, Jesus didn't come to bring judgment, but he came to face the judge on our behalf. This is the gospel, that Jesus, the judge of the universe, came first not to bring judgment, but to take it in our place. And all that is left is mercy for us and intimacy with God for those who receive him through faith and live for him. But to those who have not received them, then we'll rightly get and justly get what we deserve, which is his judgment. So the question remains, have you received him? Have you placed your faith in him? Have you placed your faith in what Jesus has done for you? And are you ready to face the judge? Those are the questions from this text. We need to live with an expectancy of Jesus's imminent return and allow it to change the way that we live our life and the way that we view life here today. Church, I hope you're having a wonderful day. And if you have any questions from this, please feel free to call, text, or email me your questions. I'm sorry about the sound difficulty on Sunday, but I hope you enjoy this message, and I hope to see you soon. Take care.